You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome back to the Gestalt Get Together. This, once again, is your podcast for talking about Gestalt language processing, as well as the autistic neurotype and the importance of making different decisions when working with this clientele, maybe with sensory choices, acoustic choices. And today we're going to talk about movement and designing an environment for how to optimize movement. We're also going to talk about how to optimize movement experiences for language, because we're here to talk about language. So my name is Corinne Smoos, MS-CCC-SLP. Once again, I love Gestalt processors. I work with them every day. They're my whole caseload. And I've had massive success applying frameworks like NLA to work with these kids. But I also, as I always say, identify myself as lovingly skeptical because I need more data. I need more information and I need more evidence. I love pulling evidence from our field's work, our body of work, but I also love pulling from other disciplines, OT, pedagogy, even from ABA, because I think that there's valuable information from a lot of different disciplines that we can smush together to make our decisions. I basically live in the journals, and I want to be able to pull those ideas in. I'll be referencing a couple of studies today in my conversation with Dr. Ruby. This podcast recording is 1 hour, and it's offered for 0.1 ASHA CEUs. And I'd love to invite my guest, Dr. Ruby Orueño. And Dr. Ruby, you've got a lot of letters after your name, PhD, M-A-L-M-S-W. Dr. Ruby, welcome. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Corinne. I'm so excited to be here. Like you, I really enjoy the interprofessional exchange because we can all learn so much from each other. So everyone, welcome. Even though I cannot see you, I believe we do have a live audience. And some people, from what I understand, will be joining later on. So welcome, whatever time you're joining us. My name is Ruby Orueño. And as Corinne has said, I do have some letters after my name. So by way of training, I'm a behavioral scientist. I have a PhD in social work and master's in social work, a master's in international studies, and a bachelor's in education. So I actually did begin my career as a teacher, training as a teacher and as a linguist. And then kind of over time, as I was trying to discover what I wanted to do with my life, I kind of ended up, on the path of social work as a terminal degree, right? So
tell me about your experience with linguistics.
Okay, so it's interesting because I did not choose linguistics. Okay, when I started off, my formative years were spent in Kenya. That's where I was born. And during that time, how you went to college was pretty much determined by how well you did in the national exams. Okay, so at that time, and even now, they still do, students in their final year of high school do a national exam. And then based on how you perform, or rather the scores you get in different subjects, they decided what was your best fit for your course in college. So I think the reason why I went into linguistics, I did much better in language arts. And I also studied a foreign language, French. So probably the people who were sitting and just kind of deciding where I should end up in, decided I'm a better fit for linguistics. Now, my first choice was to go to law school. However, because it's a highly competitive, highly competitive field at that time, I missed this points for law school I missed like 1 point to get into law school. And I was just like, now I have to go and train to be a teacher and a linguist. That wasn't my life plan. But you know what? I actually ended up enjoying it. Yeah.
Yeah. Language is pretty cool.
Yes.
Pretty awesome.
Languages are pretty cool, and because I'm actually someone who likes, who really enjoys learning about cultures, and I'm a bit of a history nerd. I love to know about people's way of life, and language is a big part of how people are and what constitutes humanity, right? So I actually ended up enjoying linguistics more than I imagined I would.
Cool.
Yeah.
Definitely going to be weaving in ideas about language, but in your current role as a social worker, tell us about the populations that you work with.
Okay, so my sister and I, we did co-found a gym called Busy Sensory Gym, which we are calling Maryland's best sensory gym, because there's none other than like the one that we already have, right? And in my role there is primarily as the community liaison person. And as a social worker, I see my role as really pretty much bridging the idea of therapeutic care with community connection, right? So I wake up every day trying to think about how can we create a space that is safe for children who are neurodivergent primarily, and who have, sensory processing differences, who have different diagnoses such as autism, and who are generally developmentally different. Create a space that is safe where they can thrive and really enjoy their childhood. Now, busy sensory gym is not something that I thought I would ever start. It is really a labor of love between my sister and I. It was born out of necessity, out of needing to create a space where our children can really be able to enjoy their childhood in a judgment-free zone where they can play and be themselves. It started out as a series of conversations. My sister and I are both parents of neurodivergent children. And a few years ago, my sister's son was kicked out of a summer camp for really just being himself. Okay. And this particular summer camp was a facility that touted itself. It labeled itself as being inclusive. They said, we accept all kinds of kids and everyone's welcome here. However, when this boy was admitted to the summer camp and dropped off on the first day, he was obviously very excited about being in this particular space that he'd never been in. And halfway through the first day, my sister received a call and was told, like, hey, listen, we can't handle him. You need to come and pick him up. And it was a very heartbreaking incident because the young boy at that time was 7 years old. He didn't understand why he was kicked out of that space that seemed to be fun and he thought he was having a good time. And it happened to be around his neighborhood. So every time they would drive around there, he'd be like, Mommy, my summer camp, I want to go back, and how do you explain to a 7-year-old like people don't want you? And so, as we were having those conversations, we started throwing around ideas like, wouldn't it be nice if we had a space where our kids could go and nobody kicked them out? And a place where they would be free to be themselves, where nobody's thinking they're weird or, they can just truly be themselves and truly enjoy their childhood. And this series of conversations and brainstorming sessions finally led us to the place where we said, you know what? We are going to build a facility where neurodivergent children can come, have a good time, be they sensory seekers or avoiders or, just have sensory differences. We are going to try and cater to all of them, and as well as all children in general, but really having those with sensory differences in mind and those who are neurodivergent. So that's how we ended up with what we call busy sensory gym.
Congratulations. I mean,
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I have to say, when I walked in, because you're local, When I walked in, it's truly the coolest sensory gym I have ever seen, ever.
Oh, thank you.
It was so great to talk to you and connect with you. And that's why I was like, I have to have you on the podcast, because what a
Oh,
cool
thank you.
story of seeing a need and then being so inspired to create and fill that need. I think a lot of families relate to that story of
Yeah.
places that claim to be really inclusive and then don't have the
Right.
resources or the training or understanding to know what that actually means and actually looks like.
Right.
It's a good marketing word, inclusive, inclusion. But even one of my clients a week ago was, asked to leave a camp. It's very, very common.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've
I mean that is absolutely true because you know, it's yeah, it's really sad. Like you said, it sounds cool for people to label themselves as being inclusive, but they're really not. And I think one of the things that also makes us unique and different is the fact that because we, you know, this is a labor of love for my sister and I, right? And because we are the founders and we have lived the experience of needing to create that space, and we are, you know, small for now. I mean, hopefully we hope to grow bigger. We are nimble enough and agile, so we are able to like adapt to the needs of the community. So again, one of the things that I do as a community liaison and also in my role as a social worker, I do a lot of listening to what the parents suggesting, what the community wants, trying to get feedback and incorporating that, because the idea for us is we feel, and really our mission is we do not want children not to enjoy their childhoods because they are neurodivergent or because they have sensory differences, right? So again, that's where I kind of put on my social work hat when I go into that space and really just listening, trying to adapt, and also trying to see, you know, what are evidence-based, trying to incorporate evidence-based things into our practices, right? Like, so when I walk into the space, you know, I also just try to reflect on like what I've learned throughout my, you know, my academic teachings, right? I'm looking at theories. What are the developmental theories talking about, right? Like Piaget and Erikson and all those other great people who've written all these things, and trying to see, like, okay, this research that was done, whenever it was done, right? Does that apply in our situation here? At the same time, trying to look at contemporary research, right, and contemporary people and feedback again from the community, and seeing like how can we best serve our community, because at the end of the day, you know, it's the mission that what keeps us going is the fact that we want all kids to enjoy their childhood.
I got a really good question from a listener, and it was actually the next question I was going to ask. It's great timing.
Yeah.
So I've seen your space, and I
Okay.
know you've got such a cool range of equipment and ideas, as well as two
Yeah.
very distinct spaces, distinct rooms. Can you share with listeners what are some of the main types of equipment you have? And then tell us about the two very different rooms.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to start by disclosure. We are not occupational therapists, my sister and I. However, we have had a lot of engagement with OTs and PTs, enough to sort of understand. And because both of us, and again, I should introduce my sister in absentia, who's not here. She has a doctorate in nursing and a master's in public health and master's in nursing as well, and she's a registered nurse. So that's her background, and also like mother of a neurodivergent child. So, you know, we've been on both ends of like healthcare, right? And so there's a lot of borrowing from the fields of training that we've had, half from public health and for me from social work and behavioral science. But specifically, when it comes to the equipment that we have, you know, we try to really design a space that meets all different dimensions, like of the human body, you know, the vestibular, proprioception, and auditory, and visual. You know, we even thought about like taste as a sense, but we're like, okay, maybe not yet. In future, you know, we have plans for that. But so to address like those major areas, you know, we have equipment that are like looking and working with on balance and coordination. You know, we have like parallel bars, balance discs. We have balls to strengthen posture and spatial awareness and regulation. We have climbing equipment. So the climbing equipment like monkey bars, we have a climbing wall, we have foam bridges. All of these target like physical strength, that bilateral coordination, right? And also just courage, because it does take immense courage to climb. I don't know, you know, many people are afraid of heights, right? So it does help to build that courage and fearlessness. We have different kinds of swings, and our kiddos love swings, especially my daughter who's neurodivergent. She loves swings. And so swings offer that soothing, you know, vestibular input. They also help like with motor planning, you know, when you're trying to figure out like how do I push myself forward, come back, and so forth. Helps physical strength, also kind of helps the posture and also the core strength. We have motion tools. So we have like trampolines and space hoppers and slides. We have like a slide, and we have like roller foam, which are just fun, and you know, just give that rush of energy and adrenaline, right? Which is fun for most kids. And I have to admit, I have tried the slides as well as an adult. Even though our gym, or I forgot to mention, our gym is designed for children 13 and under. That's an important note to something to mention. I have tried the slides, and it's such a thrill.
And you did let me go on that rolling
Yes.
landing platform, which
Did
took
you
a
feel the
while.
speed? It doesn't look like it's fast, but it's really fast, and you get quite the rush, right?
Right? And it did take a lot of courage, even for me. And I have a decent relationship with my body and coordination. But I did note it was an interesting sensation for this. And I'm how do you try to describe it? It's like a slide, but it's composed of all of these rollers. So as you're sliding down, you're experiencing this rolling sensation under you every few inches. It's a lot of sensory input because you're experiencing that vestibular input of moving downward, of that gravitational pull. But then there's also this unbelievable tactile experience underneath your body. And I was thinking about, as I went down it and I was facing my fear, I was thinking about
You
how
had time to think. You got
time slowed down.
fast.
Time slowed down. I was just
Yeah.
thinking about how many of my GLP clients who crave movement, who crave
Right.
types of experiences that help them know where their body is in space, would love something
Yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Looking around at all the different types of swings, not just
Yeah.
one type. A lot of people really love those Lycra swings that have the compression effect. Those are great. But seeing things like platform swings, different ways that these kids can really negotiate their bodies in space
Yes. Yeah.
and make different decisions about
Absolutely.
how to move their body, where to move it, and in what order. Because for so many autistic kids, the motor planning is really, really challenging.
True. True that. We also have like interactive, like stationary, I would call them like sensory stations, right? Where kids kind of like think of it like busy boards, but that are stationary and mounted on the walls, where children can just come and like really helps practice their fine motor skills, right? And initially, when we designed it, we thought like maybe younger kids would like this, but the older kids like them too, you know. We're always constantly surprised at how creative, you know, how like when you design a space and you're thinking, yeah, kids will probably play with this in this manner, but then they surprise you and show you like different ways of playing with things, and you're like, huh. So all this equipment that we have seen children like test our the depth and the span of our own imaginations that we didn't even think like, oh, I didn't even know that could do that, right? And then we also have like imaginative play equipment, like the train, the foam train that kids really love. I've seen kids do all kinds of things with the train. I was like, huh, I didn't think you could do that as well, you know? And those provide like opportunities for social engagement. You know, I've seen like when the peers, when the kids get around the train and they start taking roles, and one is the conductor and one is loading up the train. It does provide opportunities even for like speech development, right? And social interaction. So those are really you know, some of the equipment that we have in our main gym. Now you asked me to talk about the other room
Yes,
that
my
is
favorite. That was my favorite space.
People, many people do really like that room too. We have a space that we call the calm room or the quiet room. The best, easiest way I would describe it is it's the kind of place where you go once you either feel overstimulated from a lot of excitement, or you just want to escape maybe into another space where you can just be by yourself. So we have like different equipment, like we have bubble tubes with like floating fish and other things that just like when you gaze at them and they change color, and it kind of just really suits you, right? We have like different tactile tiles that have different textures that you can just like feel and just really provide some really kind of different input that's so different from what you get in the main gym. We also have like very soft rugs that you can like lie on, and stuffed animals are really cute, and it's just really calming. The light is dimmed so that you know you can just kind of like relax. And after spending like a minute or two in that room, many times I feel like I could just go to sleep.
Yeah, and you can, I could feel the difference in just like thinking about, I work with one mom of an autistic kid, a Gestalt processor, who is an interior designer, and she's decided to specialize in designing spaces for neurodivergent kids. And excuse me, she's talked about these principles of interior design and how they can help neurodivergent persons like sensory system feel safer and able to really like connect with what that environment is for. And what was interesting about your environment is I noticed that this room that is, set up for calming and to help a child kind of come back down, it's closer together, there's a lower ceiling, and so it's creating kind of this compression effect, which might be really soothing, help that child know where their body is in space just from the position of the walls. This idea of how can distance and height give signals to the body about safety? Whereas the main gym, it's the width and the height and just the lightness of the colors, the light grays, that feels more expansive. My body moves outward. So it's just very cool. Contrast of the spaces and how the design might be helping with the outcome you're looking for.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because even when we were designing the space and deciding, we like I said, we are not OTs. However, my sister is a very good designer of spaces, and she has a really good eye and feel for like design, and you know, she's the person I call to decorate, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And she really helped with like sort of designing and deciding what goes where. But you're right. That is us. For me personally, I had not thought about that in the sense that the height of the ceiling and how different they are in both rooms. And yeah, so that's wow. I mean, you know, I'm just impressed that that actually is something that you noticed and I overlooked it.
Oh, it's since I've been, working with this mom, since she's made all these discoveries, like pulling her work in with the experience of raising a GLP, she's talked a lot about even the types of materials you use, natural fibers rather than like, synthetic fibers, natural elements like wood. I mean, I remember walking into your space and the first thing I saw was on the wall that rectangle of the grass texture. And it's the first thing I thought was like that color green because it reminds me of nature and makes me feel calm. So there's interesting elements you pull in. And I think also that I see a lot of sensory gyms that use a lot of like primary colors and it's very busy. And there are primary colors you use, but I also notice you do have quite a bit of like pastels too and grays. So there is more of a muted profile than I've seen compared to a lot of other sensory gyms. I get very visually overstimulated in a typical sensory gym from the color combinations. I know like other parents have told me that they do too in therapists. And so I just, now I'm not a GLP, I'm not a neurodivergent child. But I noticed that kind of like your color scale is a little bit more contained, which the mom I work with, the interior designer, she says that having a smaller range of colors can be more soothing than like red, blue, yellow, green, those primaries.
So it's interesting that you say that because I think when it comes to something like the color choice, we mostly went with like what feels appropriate, what's calming. I guess it was more like driven by instinct rather than like, hey, we read this study that said like colors are, you know, these colors work better or these ones work better, you know. We kind of like tested with different things, you know, we'd put you know, like paint different colors on the wall and be like, okay, what do we think looks better? Okay, yeah, probably this looks better. And just ask. And we actually did ask our kids when neurodivergent, which one do you like best, better? They were like, yeah, this one. We're like, yeah, let's go with this.
And it doesn't mean the colors are boring. You still use a lot of bright colors, but it's like it's not a like in your face yellow, it's softer, soft pink, kind of an aquamarine. Something else I noticed about immediately was that the walls are not busy. Busy walls can be really distracting because for autistic children, there's this idea about enhanced perceptual capacity that they are processing and paying attention to sensory details that a neurotypical person would kind of ignore or integrate easily. And so when I walk into certain spaces for autistic kids, I'm like, there's so much going on the walls, there's words here, but all this. And then the things like the movement activities, the swings, the climbers, it's hard to tell them apart from what's behind them because the walls are busy. I really liked how you had blank light gray walls and because then it's very clear. I'm looking at a picture right now of your space. There's a ladder and it's very, very visually distinct against that light gray wall. And so it could help a child focus their attention on this task of there's a blank space behind it. I see this structure. Let me figure out what to do with this because my brain isn't trying to fight for resources to process this wall behind it. So just little things like that, I'm thinking, okay, how can the space itself make it easier for this child to succeed and try new things?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's, you know, what we were aiming for because the what people call the natural world, like out there, again, it's sensory overwhelming, right? Like you step out on the streets, there's cars, there's people walking, there's like all these colors, light, noise, whatever. It's We wanted to create an environment where someone just comes in and they're able to choose the amount of sensory input they want, right? And not just throw it, you just like give it to you and it's, And so here I'm throwing a little bit of shade to other indoor play areas. Just a little bit. I'm just being honest. I'm not gonna mention names, but the times I've been invited to indoor play areas, even I, as an adult who is neurotypical, I do get sensory overload and overwhelm, right? Because you walk into a space and there's like lots of children running, screaming, loud music, boom, boom, boom. Lights flashing everywhere, and in 10 minutes I'm exhausted, right? And I noticed over the years of like attending different like birthday parties or events in these spaces, it was becoming more and more difficult even for my child to enjoy those activities. And at some point, I just decided, well, we'll just send a gift, because what's the point of putting my child through all this? We leave the peace of our house to just be in a space where, it's too loud, it's too crazy, it's too much. I don't know at what point as humanity we decided that more is better, but I think there needs to be a move towards like less is more, because many times, it's just the quiet piece of like less helps us focus and on the beauty of simplicity, which sometimes gets lost in all the overwhelming of like sensory overload.
Yeah, it was I used to work with an occupational therapist who worked out of my clinic for a while, and she was really helping me and mentoring me about my clinic space because I am not a minimalist. I do not have simple visual spaces in my life, and she really helped me understand why and how to pare down in the environments that I was working with clients in. She explained about that visual overwhelm, about having so many choices and not knowing where to start. Or for children with attention differences, I start this, but then over here, and then over here, and then over here. And if there's a lot to, like too much to look at and process, then there might not be enough room for that social reciprocity and that back and forth. But then you mentioned the so that's me kind of nodding to my own need to keep things a little simpler in my therapeutic interactions. But you mentioned loud music. And when I'm working with, especially daycares, and thinking about the relationship to music in these therapeutic spaces, thinking about sometimes background music, which a lot of people think, what a great idea, that can be such a source of competition for language modeling. If we are looking for spaces like sensory gyms to be places where language can also grow, gross motor, fine motor, sensory integration, we want all those to grow. But if those are also spaces we want language to develop, if our voices are in competition with that blaring music, we're probably going to lose out because music is more interesting, more complex than a lot of speech can be. And so when I'm talking to like daycares or spaces, I'm saying, like, are we being intentional with the music that's being played, or is it just to fill the space? Because in a silent environment, the vocal signals, the speech signals are really going to stand out. Kind of like I was looking at that picture, your hanging ladder really stood out against the blank background. The human voice can really stand out against silence. So making those music decisions too. Now, can you share with me, do you play soft music or is it silent in the space?
It depends.
Yeah.
One of the things we also do have is like a space for private parties and events and birthdays and all of that. So during that time, depending on what the celebrants want, we'll play the music they request, right? Which is overhead. Sometimes we do ask when people drop in, like, would you like to hear some music? Yeah. So we don't have a hard and fast rule like we must do this or we must do this. We really adapt to the needs of the gym users or patrons. What should we call them? Clients, guests, our community members. Yeah. We adapt to them and we let them decide if they want to listen to some music, and we'll ask them like what kind, and then. You know, and because of how our gym is designed, we are able to play different types of music in the different rooms. So the
Oh,
main
great.
gym, we can play one kind. It doesn't have to be, and not everyone has to listen to the music, right? So if we do have someone in the calm space and they don't want any music, then they can have a quiet room and people in the gym can have their music. So, yeah.
That's fantastic. And I think that can kind of speak to there's a music theory element, musical element called tempo. And
Okay.
tempo is,
Yeah.
related
The tempo of music.
as the
Oh.
speed.
Yeah, the speed,
And
yeah.
the tempo of a song can have an unbelievable impact on our mood, on
Yeah.
our sense of safety, on our regulatory state. A very fast tempo to a song is going to ramp us up a little bit. A
Yeah.
slower tempo might help our body slow down, because there's this fascinating concept, and it's called a biomusicological phenomenon. I love that phrase, biomusicological, called
Okay.
entrainment. And
Okay.
entrainment is about how organisms, including us, we want to be synced up to our environment. Our inner
Okay.
rhythms want to sync up to outer rhythms. So if the outer rhythms, like music, are very, very fast, our bodies want to sync up to that. Even if it can get
Oh.
uncomfortable, because as organisms, we want to sync up to it. Now, for kids who are climbing and moving, that might be really
Yeah,
helpful.
right.
But in that quiet or calm room, it would
Yeah.
be kind of antithetical to have a really fast tempo in a place where we want our
Yes.
number to be slower. So I
Okay.
think that's really fantastic. Great decision for the electrical wiring, to have
Yeah.
different outputs, because you can tailor the tempo
Yeah.
what a child's body, will entrain to help them, accomplish those regulatory goals.
Okay, yeah, I can certainly see how that also translates in like real life, right? Because when I think about like many gyms, when you go to the gym, they're playing like fast music because they want you to get moving, right? And then other places like for instance, when you're boarding an aircraft, right? And they're just playing. I used to be a flight attendant many, many years ago. This was like before I got into social work. But I remember like we'd play like soft music. I guess the point was, yeah, to get people, because you know they probably come from like I don't know, it traveling is stressful, right? And they've been through a lot of things, boarding, going security checks, and you want them to be calm when they get on board.
And a lot
So
of people afraid of flying. So if you
that's
have
true.
a slower tempo and a
Yes.
slower rhythm than their body's
Yeah.
at, it
Yeah.
might help them come down.
Yeah.
So yeah, music can be very, very strategic,
Yeah.
the way that we use it. And I love to use music for helping with language too. But this reminds me of a study that I really did want to mention. It's one of my favorites.
Okay.
Excuse me. It's from 2013, and it's by Hardy and Lagasse. And of course, I am going to get get our participants their link, because I know
Okay.
you guys are going to ask for it. This is one of my favorites. So that link to the article, it's from the NIH. It's there in the chat for you. And it is called Rhythm, Movement, and Autism. using
Okay.
rhythmic rehabilitation research as a model for autism. I totally recommend, if anyone has the chance to read all of it, to go for it. I'm going to pull out a couple of ideas I think are relevant to a sensory gym.
Okay.
So the first thing, and also feel free to jump in, Ruby, if anything is of
Yeah.
interest to you. So one of the things they talk about is that autistic kids demonstrate a latency in their movement events. There's a latency in their body movements trying to accomplish certain movement goals. That might be a latency from idea to execution in the body, but also just movement to movement within like a task. We might think of climbing a ladder as one task, but it is a sequence of so many steps. And there might
Yeah.
be a
And
latency.
just the coordination of all of
Yes,
them,
yeah.
right? Like, yeah.
And so, I mean, we've mentioned proprioception several
Yeah.
times, but for autistic bodies,
Yeah.
there's an increased dependence on that proprioceptive feedback for
Right.
the postural stability. So
Yes.
for autistic kids, they need a higher degree of proprioceptive input to feel stable. And so when I see kids, like, I know it's controversial if kids should climb up the slide backwards, but when I see an autistic kid climbing up the slide the wrong way, I'm like, of course you are. You're
Yeah.
needing more of that feedback to feel
Yeah.
stable. And so I think sensory gyms are so incredible because you're giving opportunities for them to get more proprioceptive feedback to feel more
Right.
stable in their bodies.
Yeah.
So there are the thing that they talked about though is like we know that proprioception is an area that is really helpful for autistic kids and gestalt processors. But what they looked at is how to use rhythm. So we just talked about tempo, and maybe a fast tempo song could be helpful for getting a kid hyped and wanting to
Yeah.
climb and move and jump. But they
Yeah.
were thinking about could rhythm or what they call auditory feedback actually help with proprioception? Can the music or the rhythm that you choose make it easier for an autistic kid to control their body? And that's, their research pointed to that being true to a certain degree. So this idea of can we use auditory feedback like music or maybe something like rhythmic speech? First your foot goes on this rung and then your foot goes on that rung. Rhythmic speech, something very consistent. Their work points to the fact, but points to the idea that that can be really helpful for that child achieving, better control and engaging in these proprioceptive activities better. Do you want to share? Yeah.
And I can see how that could be true, like having the rhythmic, incorporating rhythm in language as a way of helping even develop speech, because I have heard this from other parents of autistic kids, and I certainly saw this in my child, how like singing was a way of like learning cognitively, learning concepts, right? And that was kind of like a way of like developing speech, right? Like before a child is it, is able to count 1 to 10, they can sing a song 1 to 10, right? And then maybe that helps them to like break down like, okay, one, that's a singular number, and then what's two is, sort of like learn the song first and then just break it down to its constituent parts.
Yes. So that's actually a perfect segue to talking. Let's talk gestalt processing. Because you
Okay.
and I, we went through the gym together and then we sat down after when we first met. And you're talking about your daughter. And I was like, she a gestalt processor? And you weren't really sure either way. So I thought,
Yeah.
why don't we talk about it? So you just
Okay.
mentioned the music and the singing.
Yeah.
And yes. Music is a go-to for gestalt language processors. One of the reasons I want to throw in just before we rewind and talk about your kid
Yeah.
is that musical memory is so strong. Working memory like
Yeah.
verbal hearing speech tends to
Yeah.
be reduced in autistic brains, but
Yeah.
musical is really strong.
It is. And if I was to just interject, for my other child who isn't diagnosed as being neurodivergent, but is a 2-year-old, yesterday, when I was picking him up from like his daycare, and one of the reports the teacher said was that they were learning about planets. And he was the only one who could name the planets all the way up to Jupiter, right? Which now I guess they said is no longer a planet, right? So something like that.
Pluto
Oh, it's
got
Pluto. Oh, it's Pluto. Okay. Anyway, yes. But to the best of my knowledge, I have never sat down to teach him, like, hey, listen, kiddo, these are the planets. But he likes this song from this YouTube channel, Mother Goose Club, that talks about there are eight planets in our solar system. So because he's listened to that song over and over, when the teacher came and was talking about, like, hey, these are the planets, yeah, he can, like, remembers the song of the planets, and then is was able to sort of like transfer that knowledge from the song to, like, oh, okay, now connect, like, yeah.
And break those smaller ideas out. Yes, you're
Yes.
speaking to this mechanism that seems to work so well for Gestalt language processors, especially for
Yeah.
songs. It's
Yeah.
there is a container of information, or what I like to call the vehicle. Music or a song can be the vehicle that
Yeah.
holds language as the
Right.
passenger.
Yeah.
So there's this song that acts as the container. It's easier to remember. Music naturally recruits the reward pathways in the brain,
Yeah.
which really, really help. We want experiences to be rewarding.
So
And then,
if people know that, and experts such as yourself know that, why aren't we using music more in teaching children who are neurodivergent or who have, like, who are different language processors?
Well, I think that's part of like this really big movement where that's why we have people listening to this podcast, joining live, having big conversations about how can we bring more musicality, more prosody into our interactions with kids that go beyond Wheels on the Bus. I think, and there's also, there's a whole field of music therapy where this is what they do. I think what I am trying to push for, and what I just today I did a training all about this. I was saying, we're using nursery rhymes, which are great, but kids in inner city Baltimore don't interact with farm animals that much for Old MacDonald. Kids out in rural Baltimore County may not take the bus that often with Wheels on the Bus. Can we use music in more intentional ways with language in it that speaks to their real life experiences? So I think, music is often used as like a reward or something nice. But this idea of can it be the medium, the vehicle for change to happen? So I think more and more people are figuring out how to do that and do it more confidently.
And also what I have noticed is, like, in addition to what you've said, music being used as a reward, it's also tends to be passive, right? Like, where kids are more like recipients of music and not actually engaging in the production of music, right?
Definitely.
Because I don't know. I do have kind of my ideas about this and why I think that is so.
Go for it. I'm interested.
Okay, so remember when I said that I am someone who's interested in cultures, right? Like, I'm a bit of an anthropologist, even though I don't have that officially as a training. Like, I like to learn about cultures and things like that. And being someone who is, like I mentioned, I was born in Kenya, I'm an African, I'm interested in African cultures a lot. We come from cultures that where music is so central to our existence. So much so, more than what we would call the Western cultures, because again, and these are my ideas, okay? So you can come after me later. I've
Please.
seen that, in Western cultures, there's rules about, like, how music is supposed to be done. This is done by specific kind of people. There's rules about it. You have to be proper. You have to be, the way music is produced and consumed, it's planned. It has to be pre-planned, usually most times. But when you go to African cultures, it's very spontaneous, right? Even though during colonization, some things were lost. Not everything is lost entirely. So much so that, like right now, when you go to, and you even see this even in places like here in the diaspora, you go to an African household, right? So, for instance, if someone's having a celebration and maybe someone is like, let me just say it's a family gathering, someone may just break out into a song. And people join in, and it's spontaneous, and it's, there's no rule about it's not weird. And many African cultures used to be like that. Song and dance was part of everyday life. It's people are singing when they're working. Someone's in the farm, they're not just like working quietly, they're singing, or, mothers are singing with their babies. Kids are making up songs as they're playing, whether it be them teasing other kids or just like praising themselves or whatever. There's like all kinds of like, so music is self-expression. Music is expression, and it happens throughout the day. And I think because of the and also not only is music expression, but it serves different purposes, right? There's music to it was also the sort of it's how, because a lot of the cultures were oral, that's how you store memories, right? You remember an event by singing about it, composing a song about it, and then you sing it to people. Back in the day, this is what used to happen, whatever, many cultures. Of course, we have cultures where there was written material, but a lot of it was mostly oral. That's how information was passed down. And so then I think, I mean, I'm not there now, but I think in those cultures, perhaps we had less challenges of maybe speech or whatever development, or I don't know. I mean, I didn't live in those days and we don't have that documented, but I think because there were no rules about like how to teach language to children, and there's singing and whatever, and there's like all the gamut of ex self-expression was so wide. Language development was probably, how would I put it? There's a wide variety of self-expression and language development, and there are no rule. I mean, there's fewer rules about like how you should speak things. Anyway, I'm just gonna stop there. I don't know. Does what I'm saying make sense?
Oh, completely. And there's so many directions I want to go with it. And this could be like five other episodes because I mean, musical anthropology is it's an unbelievable field. And I think about it's hard to know, if is there like less language delay, less certain disorders in cultures that have it's hard to say that, especially with record keeping. How do we know? But I think what you're speaking to is, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying of that. What it sounds like is in Kenya that music is used as a force for social cohesion and sending messages, especially social and emotional messages, not necessarily transactional messages. A lot of white Western culture is about transaction. It's about power. It's about it's a lot of it goes through the lens of colonialism and capitalism. I need you to talk and say this so that you can get a job and get married one day, rather than the sharing of information through emotion, through context. And that's why I think music and embedding language into music that pulls in emotion, that is about stories, works so well for Gestalt processors because they learn from these whole experiences of not just like I point to a dog and say dog, but there's a lyric about a dog that captures the feeling that they have when they see a dog. So it sounds like you're speaking to that like social cohesion that I think music comes from. Music is a way, we go back to that word entrainment. When we're singing or dancing with other people, our rhythms are lined up with theirs. We feel close to them. And with an autistic
We
child,
connect to them and
yes.
the connection, right? So that so much that there's less of like someone just being in their own world,
Yeah.
right? Even if you're quote unquote in your own world, someone is in there with you.
And I think that's so much of the work that we're trying to do when we're interacting with Gestalt processors is how can I join with this child
Yeah.
in their rhythm, in their world?
Oh, yeah.
So much of the therapy world is kid, join our world, kid, join my world, do what I do. What I just see more and more is if we go the opposite direction, I join your world in your rhythm so
Yeah.
we can feel connected. And then the child is like, oh, maybe I can do what you're doing too. Maybe I feel
Yeah.
safe to entrain
Yeah.
to you. But yeah, music is such, I in my opinion, can be such a bedrock for that. Because
Yeah.
it's setting up reward centers, it's talking to very old parts of the brain,
Yeah.
very old, like ancestral
And
brain.
the thing about like these cultures, and I can speak to African cultures, there wasn't like, oh, you're doing music the wrong way. Like, it's like, oh, you're singing this, oh, you're playing this instrument. Oh, okay, that's your thing. There's a lot of acceptance of and a lot of like creative license for people to compose and share and acceptance and a lot of other people like just joining in with them for that, and having that shared emotion and having the shared experience.
Yeah, and it sounds like that kind of emotional, musical communication is more natural. It's more improvisational. And, a lot of our listeners are using this framework called natural language acquisition by Marge Blanc, which is about you speak and you sing from a place of naturalness rather than I'm going to teach this word today, I'm going to teach this word tomorrow. It's what am I seeing this child doing in front of me? What language would make sense right now? And so when I'm working with Gestalt processors, and we're not going to have time to be able to talk about your kid today. We got to do another episode in the future to coach and come up with ideas. But when we bring in the music with these children, and I can easily do this in a sensory gym too, is what is this child doing and potentially thinking? What can I sing right now that matches up with what their body is experiencing so that everything feels like it's cohesive? Can I sing something in a way that matches their emotion and what they're experiencing so then they can pluck that language out?
No, I agree. Just and even as you're saying this, I'm just seeing like ways in which again, just using that whole music and natural music and encouraging children to like compose and express themselves through music does provide opportunities for language acquisition, right? Especially if it's in a space that is safe and they feel like there's no judgment and like there's it doesn't have to be a certain way. It's still okay, even if it's different from what some how someone else did this, right?
And
And I seem to recall again for me, just talking about like music as a way of learning, and many people who grew up like in the same places they grew up in, I mean, our first years of like school, like from pre-K to like second, third grade, there's a lot of singing and learning through music, you
Yeah.
know? And I think I noticed the difference because I thought everyone else learned that way until I moved, you know, immigrated and you know, now that I'm bringing up kids, I'm like, this is a very different way of like learning. There's a lot of singing and learning through play. And what's interesting is, you know, I guess because of colonization, we always looked up to the West as like,
Yes.
wow, you know, they're the ones who know how to do it better. And it's very interesting to see like people are going back to doing things how we used to do them. Right? So, yeah.
I think that's why I'm excited about this whole world of Gestalt processing, is it's
Yeah.
bring it back to play, bring
Yeah,
it
back
to
to play,
music,
back
bring
to
it,
making
yeah.
it enjoyable and fun and allowing the kids or the children to come up with to be the leaders in sort of like direct their learning, right? And you join them in there and support them in the process.
All right, Ruby, thank you so much. We talked about your sensory gym. We ended up talking a lot about music, which is my favorite topic. And I had a really nice time talking to you. Thank you so much to our audience, for those of
Thank
you
you so
who
much.
participated. And I hope that you all come back for another episode of the Gestalt Get Together. Good night,
And
everybody.
welcome to Busy Sensory Gym. We are located at 14600 York Road, Suite S in Sparks, Maryland. We are open 7 days a week. And check out our website, busysensorygym.com. And we're on
Perfect.
social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn. We look forward to engaging with you. Thank you so much, Corinne, for having me, and
Thank
thank
you.
you
Yeah,
to our
anyone
audience.
local, definitely come hang out. Bye,
All
everyone.
right.
Remember to visit speechtherapypd.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.